Sound Words Tape Ministry, Queensland. It's now Friday evening, the 25th of March, 1988, and we're at the Kelvin Grove High School Assembly Hall for a special lecture, with guest speaker being Mr. Lindsay Williams. His subject is the Plot to Control Australia. This is cassette number one of the evening.
We can have Lindsay Williams speaking. And having heard Lindsay Williams' tapes, as I imagine most of you have, I was thrilled to do it. So thank you for coming. But before Ian or Lindsay speak, we're going to be sung to by a very patriotic Australian family, the Murphy family.
I'd like to welcome you all and say thanks for coming along to hear our great speaker, Lindsay Williams, who's come all the way from the United States of America. And I'm sure you will enjoy his expertise. But before I get started, I'd just like to make one request, that we will be handing around pieces of paper, and I'd like you to put your names and addresses on them, if you wouldn't mind, ladies and gentlemen are here tonight, because we're very concerned at the state of our nation. And we've set up our organisation, Australians United for Survival, Individual Freedom. In short, Aussie Freedom. And this is to promote political awareness, patriotism, and begin the first steps towards government for the people, by the people. We believe the need is great for all freedom-loving Australians to become politically active, because abuses of political power are crushing us all socially, economically, spiritually, and destroying our heritage. And we offer you this concept of Aussie freedom, whereby you, the individual people, in all electorates across Australia, may select your candidate to represent you locally, with no political party hierarchy to control your local member. We intend this to be a grassroots organisation with people working for people. I believe, ladies and gentlemen, one of the greatest human experiences is to be among friends. Tonight, I know I am among friends, not just in a social sense, but because we are compatriots engaged in the most serious task of preserving our freedom, our heritage, and our great nation Australia, against the internationalists who want total and absolute people control in Australia, America, and the whole free world. But, ladies and gentlemen, as I stand here before you tonight, I must confess I am afraid. And I earnestly ask you to work hard and pray hard for the success of our campaign as we move around Australia. I decided to bring my wife and family with me to provide for you patriotic songs, which hopefully will inspire all of us to love our God, our country, and our families, and be aware of the dangerous threat hanging over Australia. Several reasons for the decline of our nation can be substantiated. The hierarchy of the political parties have controlled and manipulated their members to such an extent that political party politicians have to toe the line or lose their jobs. And I believe that Australia is being hijacked by a small band of politicians who are simply puppets of international finance and the combined forces of international socialism working hand in glove. History tells us that behind governments there are always control forces. And the involvement of the Prime Minister in the Fabian Socialist Society should be studied and questioned, particularly Mr. Hawke's speech to the Fabian Society dinner on the 18th of May 1984, when he said, quote, "For the right moment you must wait, as Fabius did most patiently, when warring against Hannibal, though many censured his delays, but when the time comes, you must strike hard, or your waiting will be in vain and fruitless." End of quote. I'm sure all Australians would like to know at whom Mr. Hawke intends to strike hard. Please note the connection between the Fabian Society in Australia and the Council for Foreign Relations, the CFR, in America. We have seen the two Fabian Society weapons, high interest rates and high taxes, destroy many businesses and farmers. We have seen our living standard undermined by crippling international debt deliberately inflicted on Australians as part of the people control syndrome. The so-called float of the Australian dollar was the greatest con trick ever perpetrated on the Australian people. In one fell swoop, our income from exports was halved and the cost of our imports doubled. The inevitable result was the acute balance of payments problem. This was carefully planned to happen. Communist leader Lenin said, "Give me control of the economy of a country and I care not who makes the laws." Let's expose the money myth. So-called credit is being sent down a cable link or through a computer screen. If we can believe this money myth, why can't we send our exports, such as wool, wheat, meat, back down this cable link or through this computer screen? No nation can borrow their way out of debt. It is a physical impossibility. I challenge all party leaders to explain to the Australian people how they can break the foreign debt stranglehold on Australia by borrowing more money. As Abraham Lincoln said, the greatest prerogative of any government is to create the credit of the nation for the people. We must push strongly to again have the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, the People's Bank, create the national credit, just as was intended by our founding fathers. This is why it is so important that we don't allow the so-called privatisation to be allowed to hock off the people's assets. The Commonwealth Bank is the key to national financial freedom. Let's deal with privatisation. This is only another word for foreignisation, or the passing of control of the people's assets to foreign control. Australians will finish up foreigners and peasant serfs in their own country. Australians have been screwed down so much by economic means that they no longer have the collateral to buy any of these public assets, which don't belong to the government anyway, they belong to the Australian people. To me, it's a bit like a farmer selling off a piece of his farm each year until he reaches the point where he no longer has any land to farm. We were warned clearly by Jack Lang in Federal Parliament on May the 15th, 1947, when he said, quote, "It annoys me to hear people talk soothingly about traitors, whom they call fifth columnists." What is the meaning of fifth column? Franco coined the word when he led the revolt against the Republican government of Spain. He said that he had four fighting columns in the field and a fifth column in Madrid. The only way he could take the city was with his fifth column, a column of traitors in the city itself. The fifth columnists of today are traitors. To call a communist a fifth columnist is only a polite way of describing a traitor. Why don't we speak the blunt truth and call them traitors? End of quote. I'd like to further quote Jack Lang from his book, Communism is Treason. And I believe these words apply to the precarious position we find ourselves in at the present time. Jack Lang said, quote, "We are already engaged in war against a deadly enemy. It is an enemy within. That can be more dangerous than the enemy from beyond our shores. It is necessary to deal with that enemy, or it will destroy everything for which we have worked and everything for which we stand. Any government that fails this country on this issue has no right to govern. Its failure is its own death warrant as a government. The call is for action. There can be no compromise between those who believe in everything that is Australian and those who serve a foreign power against Australia. End of quote. I also believe the speech delivered by Sir Colin Hines, President of the RSL in New South Wales, at a meeting held in Dubbo on the 1st of February 1988, was one which should have had national coverage because of its urgency and importance to our national defence, when he said, quote, "I believe sincerely that we are the potential victims of the greatest conspiracy ever conducted against mankind. The purpose of this conspiracy is to take over the world in the name of communism, where we will eventually have a world government with one navy, one army, one air force, with one church, without Christ." The conspirators are very patient, as they have been working towards their goal for over 200 years. Let's listen to the Soviets' own words and take notice before it's too late, particularly Communist Party Secretary Boris Ponomarev, when he said, and I quote, "Comrades, you must understand, if we wish to control Asia, we must first control Australia." End of quote. Lack of loyalty to the Australian people is at the heart of our problems. Is it coincidence that 12 months ago, the Hawke government agreed with the Soviet Union to jointly celebrate the 1917 bloody Bolshevik Revolution with our Australian bicentenary? In the first 10 years of the Russian Revolution, 15 million human beings were annihilated. Is it coincidence that after visiting the Soviet Union and speaking with Mikhail Gorbachev, our Prime Minister began the first move towards disarming decent Australians? Former communist leader Lenin advised his fellow comrades, "Before we can control the people, we must first disarm them." Australian defences are at their lowest ebb in history. We have no fleet air arm, no aircraft carriers, the highest armed forces resignation rate, and the lowest morale. If there was an external threat to Australia, we, the people, would be called on again to defend our nation and families with the guns our government leaders are so deviously trying to take from us. These guns prevented the enemy from enslaving our families and loved ones in the last two world wars. And I challenge the premiers and the Prime Minister to prove their loyalty to the Australian people by arming all decent Australians as part of a permanent standing citizens' defence force, just as is done in Switzerland, where every able-bodied man is trained and ordered to take home their weapons and ammunition to be on call at 24 hours' notice to defend their country. I hope everyone here tonight will join in the campaign being conducted across Australia at the present to obtain citizen-initiated referendum to return political power to the people, as was intended by our forefathers when they drew up our constitution. You, the individual, are the most important person in this fight. The two things the internationalists want to destroy first are individuals and families, because they work and think for themselves and one another. I call on all small businesses, people, farmers and individuals to join in this fight and use their complete business facilities, fax, telex, typewriters, etc., to spread the truth. We must have strategy. We must know our enemy. We must have the will to win. I ask the Australian people to again take up the mantle of freedom and the voice of truth. Only the truth will set us free. My brothers and sisters Australians, our great nation, Australia, is bleeding, mortally wounded by the deadly arrows of treason. Loyal Australians, I beg you, come to her aid, lift her up, nourish her. From the depths of despair and the shackles of economic slavery, free her. Please, wake up before it is too late. Stand up for your freedom and your children. Their freedom will be your reward in the face of a ruthless, heartless, godless enemy. May God bless us all and give us the courage to win this battle for our freedom. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Now, ladies and gentlemen, my family and Lindsay Williams' lovely wife, Terry, will welcome Terry by singing God Bless America. Gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Lindsay Williams from USA.
I sure am glad you're here tonight. This is a wonderful audience. I was back in the back beside the book table a moment ago. A gentleman walked in and said that he had driven a few hundred miles to be here this evening. You know, I'm loving these Australian audiences. It wouldn't take much for me to fall in love with your countryside. We started out in one of your other cities and covered four different cities between then and now, have traveled quite a few hundred miles. And the hospitality of the people, the kindness that we found in your country, I'm just falling in love with it. And I want to thank you for being here this evening. Now, be assured, I'm glad I'm here. I can honestly say that. I came one halfway around the world to talk with you this evening. So I think I can honestly say I'm glad I'm here. I think tonight I must feel about like the little boy that his mother sent him down to the grocery store to get a box of these disposable diapers. The little boy went down to the grocery store and walked up and down the aisles and found a box of disposable diapers and walked back up to the checkout stand and put them down on the counter. The lady at the stand looked down at the little boy and said, "Son, that'll be $1.03 tax." The little boy looked up at the lady and said, "No, ma'am, my ma don't use tax. She used safety pins." Now, you've been sitting here, a wonderful audience, for the past 45 minutes and have hardly even moved. Your response has been good, but just before I speak, you need to stretch. Would you do something for me? Would everyone here stand, shake hands with two people, tell them you're glad they're here, and sit right back down again? Now, that made you feel better, didn't it? At the close of the session this evening, we will have an open forum whereby anyone in the audience can ask any question they wish. Please hold your questions until after I finish speaking, and then we'll give an opportunity for you to ask any question you wish. After the meeting tonight, in the rear of the auditorium, you will find our latest two books, Where's the Food? And Syndrome of Control, and if you wish to get those after the meeting, you can. Now, this evening, I've come here to try to deal with two words, to the best that I can, to explain it to you as I know it, as I've lived it, the story that has been a part of my life for the past 15 years of what's happening in the power elite structure of the world. And tonight, I'd like to deal with two words, freedom, slavery. We have two choices. We can make up our mind which we want. We will be one of the other, either free people or slaves. And in order to describe this subject, I'd like to start where it began with me. It was 1974. They built a huge pipeline in the United States of America for the carrying of crude oil. At that time, I was a missionary in the state of Alaska, and I heard that pipeliners were very likely people in need of spiritual guidance. So I went to the oil companies and I said, "Don't you need a chaplain on the pipeline?" Well, after I arrived on the pipeline, I found out what I'd heard about pipeliners was the understatement of the year. Well, about 6 months later, the oil companies, who were paying us nothing, our religious denominations were supporting us there, the oil companies said, "You chaplains are saving us thousands of dollars of counseling fees. We've decided that we're going to give you executive status and make your life up here a little easier." At the time, I had not the slightest idea what that meant, but I soon found out it meant that I could go any place I wanted to on the pipeline, could sit in on board meetings with the oil company officials, and for 3 years' time, I was given executive status in an advisory capacity with the 9 major oil companies of America and saw the building of the largest diameter pipe that's ever been constructed on the face of the earth for carrying crude oil. You'll remember that back in those days, there was a gasoline shortage. Well, at least that's what they told us. Well, after sitting in the meetings with the oil company officials, I found out there was no gasoline shortage. There was no energy crisis of any kind. It had all been intentionally created in advance. It was done for the purpose of manipulating the industrialized nations of the world. And to my utter dismay, I found out that the energy crisis was not created by the United States of America. Neither was it created by the Arabs, nor by your country, if you happen to have a shortage here. But rather, the energy crisis was created by a group of international financiers for the purpose of testing the industrialized nations of the world to find out what would happen. It wasn't unusual back in those days for me to have breakfast with the international secretary treasurer of Exxon. After all, when a person came to the pipeline and wanted to be shown around, it was my job as chaplain to host them. It was just part of my job. It was nothing unusual. I was just expected to do it. And then later on during the day to maybe be with some congressman who was visiting the pipeline and possibly even that afternoon help host an Arab sheikh to look around the North Slope of Alaska. This was just part of my job. And in rubbing shoulders with these people for 3 years, I found out something. They don't think like you and I think. These power elite of the world think in terms of power, control, manipulation, gain, greed. That's all they think about. They don't think in terms of love and Christianity and decency and honesty. Now, it's difficult sometimes for people to realize that there is a conspiracy. And I chose not to use the word conspiracy in my first three books, because it's such a loaded word. Instead, I chose to use the word plot. It helps people to understand somewhat better, and possibly it doesn't startle them quite as much. But I'm here to declare to you tonight and attempt to prove to you that there is a plot, a conspiracy, for the control of humanity, nations, both the United States and your own country of Australia. And at the invitation of Ian Murphy, who is the head of the Aussie Freedom Movement in your country, I traveled, and my wife traveled, halfway around the world to try to lecture in 20 cities to show you what I have learned over the past 15 years about the fact that unless we do something soon, we will be slaves in our own land. We have a choice. We can either be slaves or we can be free. The choice is ours. But we don't have long to make the choice. These people are on the midnight hour. They are soon ready to pull the strings. October the 19th in America, the stock market crashed. It was not by chance. They have some very definite things in the wind. And in order to prove this to you, exactly as I learned it, by rubbing shoulders with these power elite for 3 years, and then studying them for many years in order to write the 4 books that I have, I would like to begin this evening with a number of illustrations. After I have finished the illustrations, I will get into facts, cold, hard facts. Those of you who are on the front row are going to be glad you're there. If any of you in the back would like to move up closer, please feel free to do so right now, because I have some documentation here in my hand that those on the front rows are going to be glad you're sitting there, because you'll be able to see it as it is and can verify the fact that I'm taking it from where I say I take it from. So the other night I suggested this, and a number of people did move out of the back to the front rows. One man came up to Eon after the meeting, and he said, "You know, I sure am glad I took Mr. Williams at his word and moved up to the front row. I saw some rather startling things." So any of those in the back that would like to sit on the front, if you'd like to move up here, there's still some seats, please feel free to do so. And I'll guarantee you, before the meeting is over, you'll be glad you came here to actually see as closely as possible the documentation of what I'm going to give this evening. You know, this is what I love about Australian audiences. You're so impromptu, and this is the thing I'm enjoying about your country down under. I'm going to begin in my attempt to prove the theory this evening. Yes, there's some seats there, some here in the center. Thank you so much. I'm going to begin by coming right down home where you and I are. I'm going to start with a house mortgage in order to prove to you that there is a plot, there is a conspiracy for the control of every area of our lives. The first illustration I'll use is, let's say, for instance, that you bought a house on a 30-year mortgage at 15% interest. Now, I'm sure if you happen to have done that, you realize that over a 30-year period, you will pay for that house 3.5 times its original value. That means if you buy a $100,000 house on a 30-year mortgage with a 15% interest, you will pay $350,000 total, including interest and principal, on that house over a 30-year mortgage. Now, let's say that 20 years has gone by, and you've made your payments every month. All of a sudden, there's a financial collapse. The stock market, the bottom falls out. Currency devalues, as is done in many countries, and you can't make your payments for 6 months. The lending institution knocks on your door one day and says, "We're going to repossess if you can't make your payments." And believe me, they will. When they repossess that house, even though you've already paid for it for 20 years and have already paid over $200,000 in principal and interest to that lending institution, yet they'll repossess that house. When they do they give you anything back? No, nothing. They merely repossess it because the fine print said you had to pay every month and you were 6 months behind on your payment, so they repossessed. Then they turned around and sold that house again on another 30-year mortgage at another 15% interest. Got it paid for 3.5 more times. That means that the house was actually paid for 5.5 times its original value. Question. After 20 years, when they collapsed the economy and you lost your house, was it to their advantage to collapse the economy? Sure. They got your house back without paying anything for it, and you'd already paid for it twice. Well, let's go to another illustration. You'll find this in these two books. It's the Arab world. Now, let me go back a ways in order to explain how they conned the Arabs into what they did. Oftentimes, we are prone to criticize the Arab world and to say they're the richest people in the world and they have stolen from everybody through the price of energy and oil. And when I got to Australia and saw the price of a gallon of gasoline, honest to goodness, if the Arabs had anything to do with it, they're robbing you but good. I thought we had high gasoline prices in America until I got here and found out what yours were. I would hate to have to drive around this country very long. Your prices are 2.5 times what we are paying for a gallon of gasoline in the United States of America. Well, let's look at this whole scenario as to why this happened. About 40 years ago, the international financiers, and notice where it started now, it did not start with the Arabs. About 40 years ago, the international financiers in New York found out that there was oil in Arab soil. So they went to the Arab world and they said, "We would like to build some oil fields for you. We'll produce that oil, and we'll loan you the money to do it, and then we'll make you rich." Well, now, if you were a nomad roaming the desert riding a camel, you'd fall for that, wouldn't you? And the international financiers, whom the Arabs didn't know a thing about how cunning they were, they said, "If you will take the money that you make out of this oil and put it into our banks in 30-year time deposits, and we will pay you interest on that money, and then you can upgrade and improve your country and your people." So in every Arab world, they chose a few sheikhs and sheikhs. For instance, in the little country of Dubai, an Arab country, there are 300 sheikhs and sheikhs and 4 million people. Those 4 million people are... By those sheikhs and sheikhs, everything. They're given housing. They're given school. They're given hospitalization. They're given everything that they want. It's a socialistic sort of a government. They're given everything. And as long as those 300 sheikhs and sheikhs give those 4 million people everything they want, all is rosy, is it not? So the international financiers made them rich. They were living in ivory palaces with gold-lined swimming pools. And finally, the price of oil went through the roof all the way to $32 a barrel. The Arabs became the richest people in the world overnight. And those men who had been nothing but nomads, roaming the deserts, riding camels a few years ago, now their children were out on the desert in their stretched Mercedes-Benz playing chicken. And they were flying their 747 privately owned airplanes around the world. And everybody said, "The Arabs have arrived." Well, back in those days when the Arabs were raking money in like you wouldn't believe, the international financiers said, "Okay, boys, invest. Even that interest you're getting back, you can't spend it all. There's so much of it. Invest it." Well, they said invest it in treasury bills in the United States. Invest it in gold and silver. And by the way, what did the price of gold go to back in those days when the Arabs were getting $32 a barrel for their oil? Gold went all the way to $800, $900 an ounce. And the Arabs bought it by the train car load. Then all of a sudden, something happened. That $32 a barrel oil, the bottom dropped out. They were getting $9 a barrel and $10 and $12 a barrel. And something started happening to the Arab economy. Saudi Arabia fired their oil minister. They said he can't even keep prices up anymore. You see, the thing that the Arabs didn't realize was they never had anything to do with the price of oil in the first place. Who controls the price of a barrel of oil? The Arabs? OPEC? No. They don't have a thing to do with it. The men who sit at the computers in New York and purchase the tankers of oil every day, those men tell the Arabs what they are going to be paid for a barrel of oil every day. The Arabs have nothing to do with it. So after Saudi Arabia fired its oil minister, prices still stayed down. Well, at that point, the Arabs had to do something. After all, these 300 sheikhs and sheikhs in Dubai, those 4 million people, did you ever try to take a sugar stick away from a child? I mean, it just doesn't work, does it? So the big boys said, "All right, guys, you're going to have to cash in." Well, what did they cash in? Treasury bills? No, can't cash those in. America's broke. $12 trillion national debt we have. We couldn't give them back their money on our treasury bills if we had to. But what else did they buy? They bought gold and silver. But wait a minute. What did they buy that gold for when oil was $32 a barrel? They bought it for $800, $900 an ounce. Then they collapsed the price of gold along with the price of oil. And the Arabs had to sell their gold back to the same people they bought it from. But what are they selling it back to them for? What was the price of gold today? What did it close at? About $440 an ounce. So the Arabs now having to sell their gold back by the carload because the international financiers collapsed the price of oil and they need money. So they're selling it back to the same people that they bought it from. They bought it for $900 an ounce. They're selling it back for $440 an ounce. I'd say it's a pretty good con game, wouldn't you? Well, look what Saudi Arabia did. Here it is. Out of the most reputable newspaper in the United States, the Wall Street Journal. I just took this out on December the 31st, 1987, and the article says, Saudi Arabia plans to borrow as much as $8 billion this year from the World Bank in order to finance its budget. Saudi Arabia never in its history has ever borrowed a dime from anyone before. For the first time this year, they are in debt to the international financiers. Mark my words, in less than 5 years' time, Saudi Arabia's oil fields will be again in hock to the financiers. They will keep the price of oil down right where it is today. They will break Saudi Arabia. They will refinance Saudi Arabia. They will put them in the same debt that they have put Australia in and the United States of America in. And eventually, they will re-own the very oil fields of the men that they made great at one time. And they did it all by a design plan. They knew 40 years ago what they were going to do. It did not happen by chance. It was all done by a diabolical plot on the part of the international financiers. How do I know? I sat in their board meetings for 3 years. I heard what they said. And after it was all over with, I dared to write a book entitled The Energy Non-Crisis, which told the entire story. After the manuscript was prepared, not a single publishing house in America would handle it. I sent the manuscript to every one of them. They all sent it back to me and said, "We can't handle it. You'll get sued. It's too hot of an issue." But within 2 years' time, it became a bestseller, even though it never went on a newsstand. Why? Word of mouth. All over the nation. People were hungry for the truth. They learned, and they took some action. And I dared to tell the story. And that's the very reason I'm here tonight. Because I'd like to explain that story to you exactly as I knew it, personally, and saw it firsthand. You do know, of course, what number one Red Square, downtown Moscow, Russia is? Oh, yes. It's Chase Manhattan Bank. That's right. The same bank is downtown New York in the United States of America. Why is that bank in Soviet Russia, in Moscow, number one Red Square? Why is it there? No Russian is allowed to go into the bank and have a checking account or a savings account. They don't believe in free enterprise in Soviet Russia. Then why is the bank there? For one purpose and one purpose only. To finance Russia's war machine, to build their tanks, to loan them money to make their missiles work. The exact same bank is downtown New York and finances America's free enterprise that builds America's aircraft and tanks and guns. They love it whenever a president goes off to meet with Mr. Gorbachev and comes back and says, negotiations broke down. America's got to build more arms. And Russia builds more arms. Chase Manhattan Bank finances Soviet Russia's war machine. Chase Manhattan Bank finances America's war machine. They financed both sides of the First World War. They financed both sides of the Second World War. They financed both sides of the Vietnamese conflict and the Korean conflict. They love it whenever there's war. They make money off of both sides. And they don't care as long as they have the control. Are you beginning to get the picture? Well, Congressman George Hanson did. He was a congressman in the United States of America for 12 years. very respected gentleman from the state of Idaho. Congressman Hansen finally resigned or left Congress, and one day he and I were on the platform together in a speaking engagement, and he said to me, "Lindsey, there were some stories that I wanted to tell when I was in Congress, but I couldn't. If you'll print them, I'll tell them, and you'll find it right here." It's one of the most startling exposés that you'll ever read. And the one that I'd like to relate to you this evening that will show the wickedness and the control factor of the international financiers were the Iranian hostages. Do you remember when they were held for 440 days? The Shah had been deposed. The Khomeini had come back from France to Iran and took over. 440 days, American hostages were held. Congressman Hansen wasn't satisfied that he was getting the truth in the Congress of the United States of America, and he asked if he could go to Iran and investigate. The Congress of the United States of America, even though he was a congressman at the time, the Congress said, "No, we'll give you no authorization to go to Iran." Fortunately, Congressman Hansen doesn't stop that easily. He reached in his back pocket, paid his own airline ticket, went to Iran, and when he got there, to his utter dismay, Khomeini gave him an audience. The first thing that Khomeini said to him was, "Congressman Hansen, we don't want these hostages any more than you want us to have them." Oh, you weren't told that by the media in Australia, were you? Neither were we told that by the media in America. The next thing that Khomeini said to him was, "Congressman Hansen, I'll give you one half of those hostages to take home with you tomorrow morning if you will call back to Washington, D.C., and get the Congress of the United States of America to promise to start an investigation into the relationship between the Shah of Iran, Chase Manhattan Bank, Henry Kissinger, and President Carter." Now, you'll find the story minute by minute, hour by hour, exactly as Congressman Hansen lived it in this book. He also placed it in the congressional record in Washington, D.C., in our government's records before he ever left Congress, yet the nation was never told the true story. So Congressman Hansen called back to Washington, and he said, "I can bring home half of the hostages with me tomorrow." He lists the name of the individual, by the way, in this book that he talked to in Congress. And he said, "What do you say?" The individual in Congress said, "I'll call you back tomorrow." America held hostage, the whole world in a crisis, and "I'll call you back tomorrow and tell you whether to bring home half the hostages or not?" Well, the following day, the individual did call back, and his reply was, "Congressman Hansen, you have no authorization to negotiate on the part of the Congress of the United States of America. Get on the next airplane. Come home immediately. Do not bring any hostages with you." When Congressman Hansen returned back to America, he continued his investigation, and here's what he found out. He found out that President Carter knew in advance that the hostages were going to be taken. He found out that he knew almost to the day how long the hostages were going to be kept. He also found out that the release of the hostages was not negotiated by the government of the United States of America, but rather release of the hostages in Iran was negotiated by negotiators from Chase Manhattan Bank in New York City. It was not a crisis between America and Iran. It was a banker's crisis. Chase Manhattan Bank was on the endangered list by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in America. They had to have the Shah's money into their bank. They arranged things so that the Khomeini got back into the country. The Shah was deposed. The hostages were taken. They embarrassed Iran. Iran couldn't turn loose of the hostages until the money was put in Chase Manhattan Bank. And only when the Shah's money was delivered to Chase Manhattan Bank were the hostages released by order of negotiators from Chase Manhattan Bank itself. And you'll find it right here in copyrighted form exactly as Congressman Hansen lived it. Do you really think they cared anything about America or the world or the crisis? No. They cared about only one thing, that they had what they needed in their pockets and that they became wealthy no matter what might happen to the world. There is a plot for the destruction of your freedom and of mine. Well, the latest crisis in America is this one. My wife and I decided we had to tell the story. I understand that you're having a similar crisis right here in Australia. I took this out of your own newspaper. It came from the Weekend Australian, and it's dated in 1988. And it says, the death of the family farm. It goes on to say, Australia will lose one farmer every 2.5 hours for the next 25 years. We'll end up with a few wealthy landlords like the Philippines. This came right out of your own newspaper. Well, if you think the farmers in your part of the world are having trouble, the American farmers, the farms, are going into bankruptcy on the average of every 3 minutes a family farm declares bankruptcy. What was 5 years ago, thousands and thousands and thousands of acres across America being tended, today that land is being laid idle. Who's confiscating the property? The bankers. Who's buying up the little banks? And I'll show you before the evening is over tonight that we're having massive bank failures in America today. I doubt that you're hearing the story down here. I'll show you the newspapers right from the United States of America to prove what I'm saying. And that's the reason I said you'd be glad that you were sitting in the front rows tonight. Massive bank failures across our country. And the banks, the little banks that are failing in the farm communities, are being bought up by the big banks in New York, who seem to have an unending supply of finances to buy anything they want. And I'll get around to Australia in a few moments to show what they will be doing to you shortly. So as a result, the farmers are going under at the rate of 1 every 3 minutes. We calculate that within less than 2 years' time in the United States of America, there will be shortages on the grocery store shelves and hunger in our cities. I dared to tell the story in the first book printed to tell the plight of the family farmer. And this book there is also here for you tonight to see what's happening in the United States of America. Now I'd like to make the most critical statement I'll make the entire evening. It may take a moment or two for it to sink in as to just how critical this is. But here's the statement. A number of the leading money analysts of America have calculated that as of February the 1st, 1988, for the first time in modern history, as of February the 1st, there is officially now more debt in the world than there is the ability to repay. February the 1st was the date of the point of no return financially for the world. May I briefly explain? Take the debt of the world, that is the Americans' $12 trillion debt, and the Australians' national debt, and the third world's debt, and take the private debt, and the credit card debt, and the personal debt. Take all of the debt in the world that is owed to the international financiers in the form of interest and principal. Take all of that debt and add it together. Then take all of the currency in the world, all of the gold in the world, all of the land in the world, all of the collateral that you can possibly figure in the world, and as of February the 1st, there was officially more debt than there was the ability of all the collateral in the world to repay. It has all been created out of thin air by interest, by the international financiers who wish to put the world into a debt situation so that they could foreclose. And any time after February the 1st, they can officially foreclose on the world. There is more debt than there is the ability to repay. Watch out. You've heard of the aircraft that strikes out from its home base, going in one direction. There is a point at which that aircraft can no longer return back to home base because there's not enough fuel in its tanks to do it. As of February the 1st, the point of no return on the face of the earth, for the first time in your lifetime and mine, officially was designated. There is a plot for the control of Australia, America, and the world. Now, some people, I'm sure, I can tell by looking at the faces, I'm seeing some unusual expressions out there tonight. I'm sure some people must be saying, wait a minute, Mr. Williams, you are alluding to a conspiracy. Well, let me ask you a question then, if you have trouble with conspiracy. And here's my question. Show me any time down through history anywhere you'd like to go, whether it be modern or ancient history. Show me any time where there has not been someone, some nation, or some group of people conspiring to control humanity. Whether it be the Caesars of Rome, whether it be the rulers of Babylon, whether it be modern-day Hitler's Germany. Why did Hitler go after the world? He had the whole nation bowing down at his knees, calling him a god. He had all the money a man could want. Why did he go after the world? One reason and one reason only. Power. Greed. He was mad for the control of humanity. And he went after the world. And it caused a war such as this earth has never known before. What is there today? There's a group of approximately a dozen people today who are known as the internationalist, is the word that I chose to coin in my book, Syndrome of Control. I rubbed shoulders with a few of them when I was with the oil companies on the pipeline. I have talked to some of them. These people have one goal in mind. Remember, the name of the game is control. That's all they want. They want to control you and me. But I have a message for them. I have no intention in being their slave. Now that I have given you enough theory, and for lack of time, I will cease with any further theory. I noticed one lady looked at her watch. Am I doing all right? Yeah, thank you so much. Now I'd like to go into the proof. You know, I never worry about people when they look at their watch. It's when they take it and shake it like that and put it up their ear that it bothers me. I sometimes tell people that I speak by the calendar instead of the clock. But I promise tonight I'll stick with the clock. It'll be much easier. I'd like to go now into the proof of my theory. And I want to quote Mr. Ronald Reagan, President of the United States of America. I personally watched the TV when he made the following statement recently nationwide on a newscast. And here's what he said. Quote, "They tell me I'm the most powerful man in the world. I don't believe that. Over there in the White House someplace, there's a fellow that puts a piece of paper on my desk every day that tells me what I'm going to be doing every 15 minutes. He is the most powerful man in the world." I'd like to elaborate briefly on that, and a statement that may startle you, so that you'll understand where Australia can stand in relation to America if it ever comes to a crisis. The President of the United States of America is, for all practical purposes, under house arrest in the White House today. Startling? I'll explain. A friend of mine recently, who knew Mr. Reagan years ago personally when he was an actor in Hollywood, needed to get some information to him. You see, the State Department of the United States of America just completed giving away five islands off of the coast of Alaska to Soviet Russia. They are oil-rich islands, and it was never voted on by the Congress of the United States of America. It enraged some of us American citizens. And we tried to get some information to President Reagan to tell him what the State Department was doing. We couldn't get the information through to him. Mail it to Washington. Staff never let him have it. There was never a reply, even though we tried many methods. Finally, this individual said, "I know I can get this information to Mr. Reagan. I knew him personally when he was a Hollywood actor. Whenever he's out in public somewhere, I'll walk up to him and maybe I can get him to greet me. And if he will, I'll hand him the portfolio of information." He did. He went where he knew Mr. Reagan was going to be. He was in the crowd of people. Mr. Reagan saw him, greeted him, shook hands with him. He talked with him for a moment or two. After he had talked with him for a moment or two, he reached in his pocket, pulled out the portfolio of material, and handed it to President Reagan and said, "President, you need to read this. It's vital to our security." One of the Secret Service agents standing beside President Reagan took the material out of his hand, looked it over briefly, looked back at President Reagan and said, "President, you don't want to read this." He took it in his hand and walked away. The President of the United States of America today knows only what they want him to know. Nothing gets through to him except what they want to get through to him. For all practical purposes, he is out of touch with what's happening in the nation except what they want him to know. Well, we're having some financial problems in America. You know, I can talk about my own nation. Some of the financial analysts of our country have written some reports recently. I'd like to read a few that will startle you. This one is written by Dr. Pierre Reinfret. He was the economic advisor to both President Kennedy, President Johnson, and President Nixon. He said, after the October the 19th stock market crash, he said, "In the near term, we're going into a recession, and I think it will be quite severe. We are in serious economic and political trouble and have absolutely brutal days ahead." One of the economic advisors to three of the presidents of the United States of America in the past. Again, James Davidson, who wrote the book that became famous in America entitled Blood in the Streets, he wrote recently and said, "This is the beginning of a major depression. Although he expects the stock market to bounce back up and down several times before the final crash." Donald McIlvaney, again, one of the most recognized money analysts in America. I talked with him on the telephone personally 2 days before I left America to come to Australia. He said, "A stampede of foreigners out of U.S. stock in the bond market is a growing possibility. A total U.S. and then worldwide financial collapse will follow." One of the leading money analysts of the country. Well, when I got to Australia, I found it in your own newspaper. We won't take it just from America. In fact, I clipped this one out of your Sydney Morning Herald on Sunday, March the 19th, 1988, just a few days ago. You know, whenever two companies decide they want to get business from each other, they get mad at each other. Sometimes they tell the truth, don't they? This one is good. In fact, the Bond Link Trust Company in Sydney, Australia, wanted to get some business from another trust company. So they took one half of a page in the Sydney newspaper and they tell the truth about your savings in your bank accounts. You really think it's safe to put money into a savings account in Australia, in a bank, or any kind of an institution? Well, now, I'm not saying this is a foreigner. Your own newspaper says, "I never thought I'd see this in print. This is the most fabulous thing I've seen in a long time. I'm going to take this back to America and show it to them. This is good." Here's what this Bond Link Trust Company says. It says, "Suppose you place money into a bank in a savings account at 12% per annum interest." And he said, they go on to say, that in Australia you have a 7% inflation rate. That means that 7% out of that 12% is immediately cut off or done away with or annulled by the inflation rate. Then he says, if you're in the 50% tax bracket, and I hope every one of you are, but let's say that you're in the 50% tax bracket, the taxes that you will pay on that money plus the inflation rate at the end of the year, you will have 0.5% less money than what you had when you put your money in the bank. You see, you can never win by either paying or getting interest. It doesn't work. It's a deadly game. Well, it's so deadly until this is what's happening in the United States of America. I was in Denver, Colorado on the day that this was the headlines on the newspaper. Denver, Colorado, one of our 50 states and a city in that state, it says, U.S. stings 156 Colorado banks. Did you know that in one of the states of the United States of America, on one Friday afternoon, that the government closed down 156 banks in one of our states? Did you know that? No, you didn't. And you never will. I'll tell you why. Because the rest of the United States of America didn't know it either. I was in four states adjacent to the state of Colorado in the next 3 weeks after this, lecturing, and nobody knew anything about this. There was a media blackout as off the state borders of Colorado, and the rest of the United States of America never knew this. Why? They didn't want the people to know it. It might have caused a run on the banks and some massive bank failures. Because, you see, even one of our leading economists in America and writers, Jack Anderson, he's probably the most recognized columnist in America today, he dared to print in one of our leading magazines the following. It says, "Is your bank account safe?" I mean, this man is a liberal. He's not even a conservative. And he dares to say, "Your bank account's not even safe any longer." Well, my wife and I heard about this one and decided we would investigate. It's one of the atrocities of the money system. Anywhere you find it in the world, and it could happen right here in Australia, because Bedford, Iowa, little bitty town down in southwestern Iowa, farming town in America, and Bedford, Iowa, the newspaper says that one Thursday afternoon that the federal agents appeared on the doorstep of the bank, the only bank in this little farming community. There's the man's picture, and declared that the bank was broke. Well, the bank wasn't broke. The bank was solvent, doing great. But it says Army closes Bedford National Bank. The men were armed when they stood on the doorsteps of the bank. And you see, the farmers who had borrowed money from that bank, they failed to read the fine print. Oh, you do read the fine print every time you sign a note, do you not? At your bank? I mean, your banker explains all of that little fine print on the back of the note to you, doesn't he? No, he doesn't. And you take the note home and read everything on it before you ever sign it, don't you? The fine print included? No, you don't. Well, neither did the farmers in Bedford, Iowa. And so when the bank was closed by the federal agency, in a few days' time, 150 farmers in Bedford, Iowa, received a message through the mail that they were being foreclosed on. And if they could not pay 100% of what they owed the bank within so many days, they were going to confiscate their property. Because, you see, in the fine print, when the farmer signed that note with the bank, it said that if the bank ever went broke, that the people who took the bank over could automatically demand payment, and if payment in full could not be made within so many days, that the farm would be repossessed. What does the newspaper go on to say? 150 of them lost their farms. Who got the land? The bankers. What did they do with it? Let it lay idle, like it is today, because they want a food crisis. After all, the ultimate control factor is the control of food. When a person's hungry, they'll do anything. You let your child start crying, and you'll sell the coat off your back to put some food in his mouth. They know it. And they know that if they get the farmer off the farm and bring about a food shortage in the world, in America, in Australia, wherever it may be, that it is the ultimate control factor of any people in any nation. Well, it happened in Willows, California. Same thing. My wife and I heard about it. We went to Willows, personally investigated, and they closed the bank there, confiscated some loans, just exactly like they did in other parts of America. How'd they do all this? Very simply. They did it with fractional reserve banking. Have you ever heard of it? Oh, it's practiced in Australia. Sure it is. Practiced in America too. Perfectly legal. Every lending institution in Australia uses it, as far as I know. And every lending institution in America also uses it. Now, in order to understand fractional reserve banking, I need to find someone here in the audience who looks like a banker. You see anybody around that looks like a banker? I'm looking for somebody with a nice coat on, his hair is combed. Oh, you're pointing to this gentleman over here? All right, don't move. The gentleman sitting right over here. Yeah, fellow